Welcome to It's All Journalism. I'm Jolie Lee, joined by Mike O'Connell. Today we're talking about data and journalism. The internet gives us access to data and lots of it, but how can journalists use this information effectively, both in reporting and how they present their stories? WNYC, the local public radio station in New York, has been creating useful, interactive, and yes, really nice-looking data visualizations on topics ranging from the prevalence of stop-and-frisk incidents to elections broken down by geography and demographics to even the number of people who use the subway turnstiles leading up to a Jay-Z concert. Today we're talking to John Keefe, who leads the station's data news team. John joins us now from New York City. Welcome to It's All Journalism.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So first of all, just tell us how you got into data journalism.
Well, I've been interested in journalism and data for a long time. The combination is not new. Investigative journalists have been doing this kind of thing for a long time, using data sets, crossing them, finding interesting stories in them for, you know, years or decades. The only thing that's been sort of different, I think, lately is that now it's a lot easier to do this kind of work. The tools are more readily available. They're more powerful. A lot of them are free. And the results can be put up on the web for everybody to see. So that's what kind of got me excited about 3 years ago, to see what might be possible in sort of this new era.
John, you've been described as a data journalist. I mean, first of all, would you describe yourself as that? And what does that title mean to you?
I think I've become that in a way, at least in our newsroom here. I think what it means is that I'm just spending some time thinking about data and helping people navigate it. I'm certainly not a statistician. I'm not a cartographer. But what I'm doing is I'm trying to demystify some of these big data sets and even some of the stats for folks here in the newsroom. Often that's what I'm doing. I'm helping reporters do their stories, help find data stories, help tell the existing stories in some sort of numerical or meaningful ways, and then helping them figure out where to get that data. Sometimes they end up with big spreadsheets on their own, and they come over to me and say, hey, what can we learn from this? What would this tell you? So it's sort of a combination here between helping reporters find data, helping reporters with data that they may have, and coming up with some interesting projects that might supplement some of the work other folks are doing here in the newsroom in ways that they might not have thought of. I think that you alluded in the intro to the subway turnstiles. That was a really good example. You know, we have a new arena that just opened here in Brooklyn. It opened on Friday, and Jay-Z was the headlining show, and there was a lot of concern about how much car traffic would be in this neighborhood. There's not a lot of parking, and it's sort of right in the middle of a residential area. While we couldn't figure out how to measure the car traffic, we could figure out how to measure the subway traffic. It turns out that because we tinker with this stuff, and we knew that there was data that the MTA, the subway system here, puts online every Saturday morning for the number of people going into and out of the subway turnstiles for every turnstile in the system. And so we knew that if we looked at that data, we might be able to compare, you know, previous typical Fridays to this Friday right before the concert, to see how many people left the station right there at the arena right before the concert. And in fact, we saw a huge jump in the number of people leaving the station right there. And we were able to go on the next day and talk about that, to say that maybe up to a third of the people who were at the arena, because we know how many people the arena holds, left the subway system because we saw a jump over the typical usage right before the show. So that's a kind of cool story that we were able to tell as the newsroom was trying to figure out how best to get our hands around this transit and traffic angle. So that's maybe one example.
So with something like that, I mean, I think it's pretty easy for a journalist to look at, you know, say, oh, I'm going to be able to get a raw number here, you know, say, you know, 10,000 people or whatever. And you know, I can put that into my story. But how do we incorporate then this into something like data visualization, where you're trying to present it, you know, tell the story in a different way using some of the tools of the internet provides us?
In that case, we just simply made a bar chart showing the previous several months of Fridays at that time, and then you could see the jump. So that was a pretty simple visualization, your typical bar chart. So we do those, and we try to come up with the best ones to tell a particular story. And we also do a lot of mapping, and that is something that we think about a fair amount. We're trying to be as good at that as possible. The tools, again, more and more often, they are free or affordable. So we're able to do things like that. We took a look, for example, about where stop and frisks were happening in New York City. Now, stop and frisk is a controversial technique that the police department uses to fight crime, basically to stop, question, and frisk people who they may have reason to suspect of a crime or suspect that they want to or that they aren't appropriately in a particular location at a particular time. So we actually mapped out where all of these stop and frisks were happening. And then we also looked at where guns were being recovered in those stop and frisks. That's one of the justifications for this tactic, is to prevent the carrying of guns around the city of New York. And we looked at where the stop and frisks were concentrated and where the guns were recovered from stop and frisks. And you could see that on the map, looking at a map that we made. And I don't know how many questions it answers. It definitely asks some questions and tells some stories. It looks like, according to our analysis of it, that the guns aren't being found in the blocks with the highest concentrations of stop and frisks. Now, yeah, it's from the general neighborhoods. Yes, that's true. But, you know, in New York, we live sort of a block-to-block existence. And it turns out that those guns weren't being recovered on those concentrated blocks. There may be really good reasons for that. If you're carrying a gun, you're not going to go to a block where you know people are going to be stopping and frisking you. But just the ability to see that visually and see the comparison was something that really led to a lot of discussion and stories on our part. A related story on that. A reporter on that beat came over and said, "Hey, I'm hearing a lot of folks talking about teens being stopped and frisked on their way to school, even. And I want to do a story about that." So she came over to my desk, and we charted out the blocks where the teens were being stopped and frisked the most, and we could see that. And then we overlaid that with all of the high schools, and we could see near some of these sort of concentrated areas, there were some high schools. And high schools our reporter had been to before and knew folks at, and so she looked right away and said, I know people at that high school near that concentration area. I'm going to go there and talk to the principal and a couple of students, see what I can find. She literally grabbed her jacket and left my desk to go to that school. So using two data sets, the high schools and the concentrations of teen stop and frisks, looking at a screen on my computer, she was able to go find out where to go talk to people. So she was using data to do her reporting. So we ended up actually making a visualization out of that to go with her story. But the initial impetus for that visualization was just to see where the story is. And we're finding out more and more often we can see geographically where stories exist.
And maybe you're not the person to ask this. Maybe this is an editor's decision. But when you're bringing in different data sets, you know, how do you sort of balance the relation between the sets of data, in that they you know, there's a cause and effect, there's somehow that they're related to, you know, the story that you're trying to tell?
Well, we have to be pretty careful with that, obviously. I mean, you can, just like in any statistics and any graphic, you can really, even by use of different colors, certain colors, you can convey an editorial opinion about something, and that's not our goal. It's really about informing and understanding the world around us and telling a story if one exists. So we think about that a lot. We've been pretty open about taking on some criticism about that sometimes. I mean, we're not professional cartographers. We're doing the best we can. We're actually hooking up with some professional cartographers to help us to make sure we do those kinds of things right. It's really easy to tell inaccurate stories with map or with statistics. And we try to do, just like with all of our journalism, we want to be as accurate as possible and as ethical as possible. And the more that we can do that, that, the more that we are trusted. What is it? There are lies, damn lies, and statistics? sure. But if we can do it right and, you know, seek help when we need it, I think that's an important moment, you know, when we think, okay, is there another explanation for this? Interestingly, we haven't done a whole lot of correlation, sort of what you're discussing, I think, where you might see a correlation, but then is there causation? And we haven't actually done a whole lot of correlations because it is, you know, really tricky. It's hard to do that right. Good investigative reporters do that. We intend to do more of that, but we won't do it on our own. We're going to be working with statisticians and cartographers when we're really going to do some intense correlations.
Now, are most of the data you've been using government file?
For the most part, we're taking advantage of the open data that's out there. You know, open data can be inaccurate, it can be dirty, it can be needing of standardization, and it can be wrong. And so we have to take that into consideration when we're doing what we're doing. I try to encourage folks who are doing this kind of work to think of it like any other source. You know, any source, you have to think about its validity, a source's validity, whether they're telling the truth, what's their reputation in the past, can you confirm it with other means? And so we try to do that as well. It's basically applying the same principles of journalism you would do when you're choosing to interview somebody, but instead you may be interviewing numbers.
Well, yeah, you want to make sure that the information that you get is you can trust. It's the, as you said, just applying the same rules as that you would with any other source. You know, let's say I'm a reporter. My newspaper, my website, we haven't really done a lot of, this type of data mining to support a story. But there's something that comes up that I feel that would be, I want to get my feet wet in this. You know, what's the best place to do that?
I would suggest a couple of things. One, especially if you're thinking about processing data and putting some of it online, there is a group called Hacks Hackers, actually an affiliation of lots of different meetups, really, around the world, and a lot in the U.S., called Hacks Hackers. They're basically groups of people who get together who have computer backgrounds and journalism backgrounds. Some of them have both. Some of them have one or the other. Check out meetup.com and look for Hacks Hackers, or if you go to Hacks Hackers, search for Hacks Hackers on the web. You may be able to find some place in your area. The other place I would go is the Investigative Reporters and Editors is a really great resource. It's IRE.org. And they have a lot of resources, information about census numbers and about techniques and tips. And there's a subset of that site and that group called NICAR, which is the National Institute for Computer Assisted Reporting, NICAR. And there's actually a mailing list where you can get onto a listserv. And there are folks there who are always willing to help people out to navigate this kind of information. A lot of folks have looked at the same kind of data sets before. Maybe it's, you know, same-day lenders or maybe it's some crime statistic. And somewhere, someone has had to wrestle with the same kind of data and maybe even the same data set that you're looking at. And the cool thing about this community is that they're so willing to help each other out. For a competitive industry like journalism, the fact that the sort of the data journo coder geeks are so helpful to each other is really, really inspiring. It doesn't mean that we won't scoop each other, because we try to do that all the time. But we really do, everybody really does share sort of the tools of the trade, best practices, and, you know, is really willing to help out even newcomers. So those are the two places I would start.
Now, when we're talking about tools, what are some of the tools that you use?
So we use a lot of Google products in our work, largely because they're so easily shareable and they're for the most part free. So we use Google Docs, Google Spreadsheets. Google Fusion Tables are actually really powerful. If you take a little time to look at those, they're kind of like spreadsheets on steroids, and you can do really simple, fast maps with those as well. Those are great things to work with. I've been using also open source mapping tools like Mapbox. And CardoDB, those are two websites that have really good tools that can be a little bit more geeky, so it takes a little bit more digging on those. And for the super geeky, I use an open source free tool called QGIS, that's QGIS. Used to be that only cartographers or institutions with a lot of money who could buy these sophisticated mapping programs could do some of this analysis. But now QGIS is an open source, built by the community, mapping tool. So if you're really going to dive into mapping, that's a really great tool. So those are, I think, the main things that I end up using. I also use I do a lot of sort of light coding. I'm not an intense coder. I'm getting better and better as often as I can to program in Ruby and JavaScript and HTML. And I use a program called TextMate, which is just a really sort of sophisticated text editor to write code and HTML in. And really, that's about it right there. Sometimes we do more sophisticated things using databases like Postgres and other things, but for the most part, I'd say 80 to 90% of what I've been doing has been on these sort of free open source tools.
So you know a little bit of coding, but for a reporter who's just getting into this, how much coding do you think they'll have to learn?
They don't have to learn any, frankly. I mean, the tools that are out there right now, you can make maps out of Google Fusion tables without a single line of code. And they're really easy to do. I can teach somebody in about 15 minutes about how to do that. And anybody who pokes around, I have a couple little tutorials on my website, which is johnkeefe.net. Poking around, it's pretty easy to find out how to do that. I will say, though, that if you want to be valuable and really excel in certainly data reporting and certainly visualization, you need to learn how to code. And I don't mean you need to learn how to do it to code in order to do things, because you can certainly use tools. But I guess I'd say that if you know how to code, you're going to be so valuable and you're going to be able to do so many more things and exactly the things you want. I mean, the whole point of journalism, right, is to get those stories out there, tell great stories, accurate, factual stories, and a lot of times it's like doing it in a way nobody has done it before, right? Well, with coding, you can actually come up with mashed numbers together, do things in ways that you couldn't do, that maybe nobody has done before. And I don't mean you have to be able to write the next word processing program or spreadsheet program, but just the ability to tinker with code, to put things online, to show other people, really, to just show other people what you're trying to get across. I firmly believe that journalism needs more journalists who can code. And as somebody who's actually had to spend some time looking for coders to do projects, I can tell you that there are not a lot of cross-trained journalist programmers out there. So if anybody is looking for a niche to get into, this is one to do. And I think, frankly, the future of journalism is going to require it. The rest of the world is processing data and coding right now. The banks are, the politicians are, the municipalities are, the cops are. Everybody is looking at data and they're processing it. And if we as journalists say, oh, you know, caution, journalists doing math, you know, the old joke, we don't do that, then we're not only are we missing the stories, but we are basically writing off a whole lot of sources and sort of making the decision to not take part in that and to not be good at challenging people or institutions when they present their own data. So I think it's actually essential.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, in the last week I saw a tweet that somebody put out. Maybe it was you, maybe it was some other journalist pundit, who said that all journalists should code. Has put that down as a tenant. I think they certainly agree with you. Now, talk about the 30 and 30 project and how you worked with reporters to develop data visualizations for that.
So this is the 30 Issues in 30 Days project, and it's something that's a theme that we've been doing here at WNYC on our talk show for several elections now. It's sort of our answer to the horse race, right? So if everybody's covering the polls and who's ahead, we're actually going to look at 30 issues that are relevant in 30 days. And this year, what we decided to do is to try to help everybody understand those issues through some form of visualization. Initially, we really wanted to do 30 visualizations for 30 days to go along with every issue. That turns out to be a lot of work. The data news team here only recently grew from one, me, to about 3.5, which is fantastic. But we still that's still a lot of work to do a new visualization every day. So we've been doing, we're probably doing about half of them in the end. And really what we did is we, the talk show that does this, the Brian Lehrer Show, had been thinking about the issues that they wanted to hit on during the entire course of this this sort of run. And we started looking at each of those topics and trying to think of ways that we thought might be good to visualize those things. There are producers who are assigned to work on collections of these issues too. So we met with each one of them and talked about each issue and thought what would be a good way to sort of present this. And we came up with some good ideas. Some ideas didn't work out. Some ideas we tried and, you know, kind of got it across. One of my favorites was that we were really talking about, one of the issues was higher education and the cost of higher education. And we came up with this idea of just making a simple calculator where could you put your college into one box and your graduation year into another box, hit a button, go, and find out, you know, what it cost back when you graduated and what that would cost today, given the price of education today at the university and the adjusting for inflation. And we made this very simple calculator that did that. And we also know that in public radio we have a large number of college-educated folks. So we thought we could actually hit a nerve with folks and try to get them to understand how the cost of higher education has increased. And it really did. We found the data. We went looking for it. We found it. We had solid numbers back to the mid-80s, and we had more generalizable numbers before that for every higher education, almost every higher education institution in the country. And we just poured it into this little program, and that worked. And it comes with a little bar graph so you can see how big the jump is. So there was just one simple way to help tell the story. And that's something I guess we haven't really touched on yet, but for every one of these, we try to tell one story well. And often reporters come up to me and say, hey, I have this idea and I want to make a map. And beyond just putting points on a map or bars on a chart, what I'm always interested in is what story are you trying to tell? What information are you trying to convey? Are you trying to help see that there's a concentration of things happening in a neighborhood? Or are you just kind of showing that here are the locations, there might be one near you? What are you trying to provide? What story are you trying to tell? And if we can, in these sort of journalistic endeavors, tell one story well, then I think we've done our job.
I think we'll all be looking to WNYC for some data viz, like, inspiration. But I wanted to ask you, just what are some news organizations you look to that you think are doing a really good job at this?
Number one among them, I think, is the New York Times, which probably isn't a surprise, but they do amazing stuff over and over and over again. Also, the LA Times. Really amazing, really doing good work. The Chicago Tribune, I've always looked to them for amazing work. And I'll say that a lot of folks at these institutions, these organizations, are also really great about sharing how they did everything. And we've sort of tried to carry on that tradition, too, not only sharing the visualizations, which we do, we try to make them all embeddable and shareable, but also we talk about how we did it and even share code so other people can do it, too. And that is a tradition that these other organizations have been doing for a long time. The Texas Tribune, also doing really great work. National Public Radio, they have just hired somebody from the Chicago Tribune, Brian Boyer, who's one of the leading journal programmers in the field, and they're putting together an amazing team and already have put out some really amazing work under Brian. They had done really nice, great maps and things before then, too. So they're the folks that sort of we keep an eye on. ProPublica, is another one. They have an amazing team of folks doing great stuff. Mother Jones. Mother Jones is coming up with some really creative things as well. All of those outfits, you know, keep an eye on them. Everybody is sort of working out new ways to do visualizations to make it easier. And the coolest part for journalists is that they're all to an organization. They're sharing how they did it.
So if you could pick out one, I'm gonna say you're gonna go on a desert island with one data visualization, one that blew your mind. Which one would it be? Not necessarily yours, but just out there.
I don't know that I can answer that right now because there's so many that are so amazing.
What are you working on now?
So recently we had presidential debates, and for the first one, we actually came up with this idea. Our political editor on Monday had this idea of making a interactive bingo card, something you could watch the debate with, but not just a thing you could print out, something you could actually play.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
My wife showed me that last night, as a matter of fact. So it was you guys who did it. So great.
It was so fun. The coolest thing about that, though, is that we came up with that. Well, we brought that idea on Monday morning. And by Wednesday morning, 48 hours later, we had it live and running online. It was designed. It was functioning. It was shareable. All of the tiles are randomized. They're very clever. The folks who worked on the content of this were really clever. And so we actually built that really, really fast. And it's not journalism, but it's engaging. And more importantly for us, it was a way to highlight our work and try to make something on News Time in 48 hours based on an idea that could be used everywhere. And it got a lot of pickup. And so in answer to your question, what am I doing right now? We are actually working to buy, I hope within the next little bit here, even today and the day we're talking, I would like to, we're going to try to put up a white label version of this card. We're actually going to make it open source so anybody can put their own logo on it and their own tiles, and any news site or any site could actually make and use an interactive bingo card the way that they want to do it. And this is part of our sort of public media spirit. Yeah, we did something really, really great. And now you can either use ours, we're going to keep doing this for all of the debates, or you can make your own and we'll give you the kit to do it.
Oh, that's amazing. And you know, a few years ago or a year ago, they were talking about, you know, gamification. You got to turn it into a game to engage people. And that's something that I heard. But anything that you can do to get people involved in the story, the fact that you've got probably people who may or may not have been following the debate very closely, actually listening to what is being said, is probably in itself an accomplishment. So you should be happy about that.
Interesting. I mean, on one hand, I thought, you know, this is kind of a frivolous, fun thing. We know that people are going to be doing this anyway, and that it could be an engaging thing, and also maybe spark some discussions in our chat. And we knew that it wasn't, you know, highest form of journalism. But then this morning we were talking about it, and last night people were actually listening for things like mentioning of specific tax loopholes, or thinking about the Citizens United case, or other things that we had put on the card that we thought, if people are actually listening for those things, you do have to actually pay attention to the debate. And so maybe there was some actual, you know, civic function there. Mostly it was fun.
Well, yeah, it's kind of interesting because, you know, if they don't check off anything, then are they disappointed in saying, well, wow, you know, none of these topics, which apparently were important, were touched on, or all these other ones were that I didn't know about.
We reviewed that this morning. The debate, this first debate we're talking about right now, we thought it would be far more wide-ranging, actually, than it turned out to be. It turned out to be very focused on the economy. And we had things like the Fast and Furious, war on women, things like that, that were a little bit more more broadly domestic. And so we were reconsidering not so much just the coding of it, but also the programming, I mean, but also the content, and thinking, okay, how do we do this even better next time?
Well, that's pretty amazing. Do you think you can adjust your games or your cards in the next debates?
Yeah, we have some version 2 tricks up our sleeve we hope to roll out for the coming debate. So we'll keep an eye on that.
Okay, well, that's excellent. Thanks for talking to us today and giving us some things to think about as far as data journalism goes.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of media. This episode was recorded on October 4th, 2012, in Washington, D.C. To learn more about this episode and for a list of online resources from John Keefe, go to itsalljournalism.com.